begin with the Bambino beats the Black Sox, how Chicago's curse failed to captivate a nation. Bryce McNeil of Georgia State.
Thank you. My story starts in 2004 when I was watching Game 7 of the ALCS, the Yankees versus Boston, amongst Boston Red Sox fans at a bar in Atlanta. And there was a 10-3 lead in Game 7 in the ninth inning, and despite this, all the Red Sox fans were still petrified that somehow they were going to find a way to blow this. And to me, that epitomized the efficiency of a curse, goading a group of otherwise rational human beings into irrationality. Even up 7 runs, their team was fighting the odds. The following year, the Chicago White Sox broke a 88-year World Series drought, but their win was an all-time ratings low for the World Series, and it was a 32% drop from the year before, despite the fact that the Red Sox win was, artistically speaking, rather mediocre. And I thought, well, why such disinterest when the stories are, at least in a sentence, very similar? You have one bad decision in a franchise's history followed by 80-plus years without a championship. Well, today I'm going to discuss the functions of a curse and describe 5 reasons why the Red Sox curse proved more compelling than the White Sox. In doing so, demonstrating the necessity of certain narrative elements to serve the functions of a curse to the casual sporting fan. So first, a brief description of the teams. Many of you may be familiar with them, others maybe not so much. The hitless wonder White Sox managed to win the World Series in 1906, then again in 1917. However, players whose motivations have been subject to many historian speculations conspired to throw the 1919 World Series. Despite court acquittals, 8 players were barred from baseball. And from 1920 to 2004, the White Sox made only 4 postseason appearances with 1 World Series loss in 1959. Hence, a case is made for the curse of the Black Sox. Boston won 4 World Series from 1912 to 1918. In 1920, owner Harry Frazee sold pitcher, outfielder, slugger extraordinaire Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees for $125,000 and a $300,000 loan. Title hopes were dashed for years to come, and the team withstood many notable almosts before winning again in 2004. The curse of the Bambino, Ruth's namesake, is the most popular title for the Red Sox fate. So we come to the specific teams that won the World Series. In 2004, the wildcard Red Sox won 98 games and then swept Anaheim before the dramatic high point, I think everyone would agree, which was the unprecedented 4-game rally from the 0-3 deficit against the hated Yankees. Their World Series win after was very anticlimactic. The White Sox, the following year, won the AL Central with 99 games, then swept Boston and eliminated Anaheim in 5 games, and then had a sweep of Houston, and even though their win was a sweep as well, it was actually a very entertaining World Series. I don't know how many of you watched it, but all 4 games were very close and very compelling to the logical mind, at least I thought. But the failure of the Black Sox narrative to enthrall the nation proves that the power is in more than a close game. Joseph Price, who's to my left, notes the prominence of superstition amongst baseball players, but also notes that the most identifiable curses are the ones from which the fans seek the spirit's annulment. For supporters, hexes provide cosmic cause for failure, which absolves them for lack of faith or dutiful support. There is a sense of Calvinist fervor to those who proudly correlate a sporting curse to their team of choice. Much as religion does, it provides a sense of meaning, consoling even as it agitates. A team loses for reasons trivial as Gatorade on a baseball glove or over-eager fan interference, proving that there must be a baseball god. Vengeful, perhaps, but the games bear out his divine imprint. Cursed teams lose because they are meant to lose, and this is somehow a warmer, less spiritually detached message than to suggest they lost due to terrible mental relief. This is evident in how fans tell stories. Curses are understood as speech acts, declarative reinventions of history. It is seldom that the speech act actually ever occurs. For example, the curse of Billy Penn in Philadelphia is really ridiculous. Billy Penn's been dead for 3 centuries. I don't think he put a curse on any sports teams that he didn't know existed. It is seldom that the speech act ever occurs, but the imagining of such sentences creates a breaking point, a start of a new history. Therefore, logical sensibility yields to the belief that supernatural forces must be appeased for cursed teams to triumph. Instead of setting up a same old championship win, a transcendent victory is foretold, a crossing over to another plane of existence where the old history is left behind. The White Sox never captivated the nation this way. Granted, there are simple geographical reasons. For example, the Red Sox primary fan base spans a wider area, and the White Sox share a city with another team. The White Sox win also came the year after Boston, so some of the magic was gone there as well. However, the Red Sox emerged as one of the most popular sporting franchises in America, due in no small part to a number of narrative elements that gave both the curse and team its life. And I will focus today on press coverage, issues of visibility, the cast of characters, emblematic moments, and scandal. So first, press coverage. A cursory LexisNexis experiment reveals the lack of ink on the White Sox curse. Scanning the Boston Globe archives from 1989 to 2004, 98 articles contained Red Sox, curse, and 1918. Conversely, a 1990-2005 Chicago Sun-Times search revealed that only 11 articles contained White Sox, curse, and 1917. And not surprisingly, many of those 11 articles mentioned the White Sox in passing while discussing something else. Granted, this is not the most scientific method to gauge pervasiveness, but newspaper stories are certainly a large part of sports narrative. The curse of the Bambino became a more marketable trope in the 1990s after Dan Shaughnessy's 1991 book of the same name. Sports writers were more likely to refer to it than any other misfortune. Bill Simmons could often be seen lamenting this misfortune for fans across the nation. Major sports networks like ESPN or Fox Sports did very little to dramatize White Sox problems. For example, in 2004, ESPN ran a mock trial in which an impartial jury was left to decide which curse was more legitimate, the Cubs or the Red Sox. Now, going by sheer numbers, the White Sox curse was a year longer than the Red Sox, but the story of the Red Sox near misses was far too compelling to pass up. Former Boston Globe sports writer Peter Gammons was even more influential. His rise to Sports Illustrated then ESPN gave Boston's misfortune a publicized poetic element. Seth Munkin describes how this transformed the Bo Sox story from regional to national. They were steeped in romance and tradition, and their losses were proof of life's tragic nature. The Red Sox were considered a world-class team and one that was discussed in sacrosanct terms. The White Sox curse, on the other hand, was often in the shadows of the longer drought from those lovable losers of the North Side, the Cubs, who have not won the World Series since 1908. The Cubs aligned their substantial misfortunes with the Red Sox in 2003 to harvest the attention of media marketers during the failed playoff run of both teams. One White Sox fan's blog site, Kabune.com, chronicles what he perceives as a Chicago Tribune bias towards the Cubs. A second LexisNexis experiment bears this imprint out across the nation. When you search a 20-year archive from the nationally circulated papers, the New York Times and USA Today, you will find that articles referencing the Cubs and a curse more than doubles that of the White Sox. Second, the Chicago White Sox drought is mathematically real, but not displayed in a plethora of visual markers. The Bo Sox wear the markers of their curse and their stature. This is evident in both continuity of uniforms and in its pre-modern stadium. Every major league uniform has undergone some changes. You know, they change all the time these days. But the Red Sox alterations have been fairly minor. Conversely, the White Sox current Gothic lettering was only introduced in 1951 during the Go-Go Sox era, and they actually abandoned it in the 80s for a hideous-looking logo that many of you may recall. The official team website describes it as a red, navy, and white color scheme highlighted a forward-looking design, void of tradition, emphasizing void of tradition here. The go-go look reemerged in the 1990s, but the continuity was broken. The average fan is thus less likely to correlate the Chicago White Sox of today to narratives of the past. However, nothing speaks to the mythos of the Red Sox and lack thereof for the White Sox more than the team's stadiums. Ritzer and Stillman described three eras of baseball parks: early modern, late modern, and postmodern. The true early modern ballparks, like Wrigley Field or Fenway Park, are decidedly small, quirky, iconic, urban, and historical. These parks were rapidly transformed from old and outmoded into thoroughly enchanted settings in which to watch a ballgame. The postmodern ballpark, they argue, is a fake, an attempt to reverse the McDonaldization of the late modern carbon copy AstroTurf stadiums. The return of real grass and the surface charms of, they cloak the amenities of a late modern ballpark. So basically, the postmodern ballpark is a late modern ballpark in disguise, pretending to be pre-modern. The White Sox departed from their pre-modern history amidst much protest in 1990 with the demolition of old Comiskey Park. Spiro and Bennett note that the new postmodern Comiskey was initially well-received, but quickly became one of the most inconsequential ballparks in America, usurped by such buildings as Camden Yards in Baltimore or the ballpark in Arlington. New Comiskey was a failure, described by Michael Gershman as a ballpark without a heart, a ballpark. Postmodern parks try to present a veil of tradition, but tradition did not translate in the new Comiskey, and the new corporate name only made things worse. As you may know, it's U.S. Cellular Field, which is shortened to the Cell. Many consider a curse to be some form of purgatory, but a prison is not likely to be their location of choice. Michael Ian Bohr, on the other hand, measures the efficiency of Fenway Park via Michael Schutzen's 5R framework for understanding the efficacy of cultural objects. Fenway, he maintains, is high on retrievability because it's visible and it's easily accessible. It has rhetorical force, it's considered authentic. It has resonance, it's part of tradition. It has institutional retention, it's old. And it has resolution. It animates its fans and it motivates them to action. Now, U.S. Cellular Field has undergone 7 renovations in its lifetime, which is a very short lifetime, and faces opposite of the skyline, thereby it deprives it of Fenway's urbanity. Even the voice of Harry Carey alluded to Chi Sox. After building a local following as a White Sox announcer, he made his national reputation as a voice for the Cubs. So now the Harry Carey statue sits before Wrigley Field instead of the Cell. Third, Boston's misfortune is carefully articulated through the lens of their arch rivals, the New York Yankees. The Red Sox-Yankees rivalry is filled with crucial successful moments for the Yankees. The 1949 weekend series for the pennant, the 1978 AL East tiebreaker, and the 1999 and 2003 ALCS. If the Red Sox personified the godliness of losing, the Yankees personified the excessive, arrogant, or even satanic qualities of winning. One journalist writes, the one constant in the rivalry was that the Yankees always won in the end, a fact that became a significant part of the lore. So the Yankees essentially are the foil that make the Red Sox look like David against Goliath. The White Sox biggest rival, on the other hand, were and are the Cubs, who don't even play in the American League, so they only play 6 times a year and it doesn't have any ramifications on each other in the divisions. The longer losing Cubs were deemed more lovable by both the citizens of the city and baseball fans at large. A market fact survey in the 1980s revealed an overwhelming majority of self-identified baseball fans in Chicago rooting for the Cubs, a result that post-survey attendance figures seem to support. And even now, after the White Sox won them, it took the White Sox winning the World Series for them to really even compete with the Cubs in terms of attendance, and even now I think the Cubs are still the bigger draw. The Chi Sox division rivals are pretty unremarkable. You have the Kansas City Royals, who are very lowly, the moderately respected Minnesota Twins, and the also-cursed Cleveland Indians. The Detroit Tigers only became division mates in 1994, and no natural rivalry has yet emerged. So there really doesn't seem to be any evil empire that the White Sox were fighting to make them look like David. Fourth, White Sox history is not filled with the would've, could've, should've moments of Boston folklore. If a sporting curse is to attain religious power, it needs to fill its Bible, its Torah, its scripture, with memorable passages that define its sanctity. The Red Sox seem to produce at least one of these moments every decade. In 1999, the Sporting News unveiled its 25 greatest moments in baseball. 6 involved the Red Sox. 2 were postseason Red Sox home runs, which ultimately led to heartbreak. 2 dealt with World Series losses, and the remaining 2 were Yankee triumphs at the Red Sox expense. Any Bo Sox fan will happily remind you the torture was not the constant losing, but rather the verge of winning. Losses that seemed so improbable one could not help but believe that divine intervention was involved. A 2-out, 2-run lead in Game 6 of 1986 evaporated through the arms of Rich Gedman and the legs of Bill Buckner. A 5-2 lead in Game 7 of the 2003 ALCS that would have stood if manager Grady Little had removed Pedro from the game earlier. A narrow 1975 World Series loss arguably aided and abetted by Game 3 catcher interference, not to mention a 9th-inning 1-run rally by the Cincinnati Reds in Game 7. The Black Sox may have put a curse on the White Sox, but no one has ever witnessed a specific moment that embodies a ghost or a supernatural spirit. One fan in April 2005 stated, "We never get mentioned because we've never had anything bad happen." Loudmouth White Sox manager Ozzie Guillen described it more colorfully. Asked about a curse, he replied, "It's a bunch of bullshit people come up with. We lose because we've had a shitty team for a long time." If anything, the most memorable moments of the White Sox have been the goofy 1970s publicity stunts of former owner Bill Veeck, such as colored baseballs, shorts as uniforms, and the still infamous disco demolition night. These tactics removed the team further from tradition and folklore and distracted from the on-field heartbreak. The White Sox Bible, it appears, is thin on holy passages, but long on gimmicky action sequences. And fifth and finally, the Chi Sox curse recalls an event Major League Baseball would rather forget. Since 2002, baseball players have been reeling from steroid abuse accusations, and it seems like there's not a 6-month period that doesn't go by with some revelation about Balco or something to that effect. Major players mostly offered silence as testimony before the House Government Reform Committee. Barry Bonds, set to become the new all-time home run king, is continually accused of steroid use, and there was a new book last year that made new allegations to that end. This, combined with lingering disaffection from the 1994 strike, has left Major League Baseball working to maintain trust from the average fan. Now, perhaps no sporting event in history created such disaffection as the Black Sox scandal, nor has any event reminded people of how greed can destroy the integrity of the game. Asenoff documents the resulting cynicism. The national pastime was nothing more than another show of corruption. If you could not trust the honesty of a big league World Series, what could you trust? Purposely evoking these feelings and evoking this scandal only serves to remind people of a potential loss of trust today, a subject that baseball would rather avoid. Hence, it's not often the subject of publicized mysticism, at least not courtesy of Major League Baseball. Aside from a few rare examples, the biggest example of the publicization of that mysticism around the Black Sox scandal would probably be Field of Dreams, released in 1989. Other than that, it's not really celebrated the way the Red Sox curse is. The White Sox seem to be sentenced to obscurity more than any other supernatural doings. I restate that curses for the average fan succeed when they create cataclysmic expectations. So to me, the more people really believe something supernatural is going to happen when their team wins, the more they really are buying into the curse. There is no shortage of championship droughts, especially in baseball. You have the Giants and the Indians as well. But only a select few accumulate enough folklore to convince the average fan that supernatural forces are at work. The power is in the narrative. Bohrer says it best. Tradition helps. Public symbols are, in effect, pedagogical tools, charters for the transmission of cultural knowledge from one generation to the next, and so on. Limited transmission equates with less belief. Red Sox GM Theo Epstein called the Red Sox rally from an 0-3 deficit to the Yankees the greatest baseball story ever told. It certainly was a story rich in tradition and heritage, a heritage lacking in a White Sox success story that brought catharsis to the South Side, but left the baseball masses underwhelmed.